Greetings. Welcome to Media Manners. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, December 12, 2010, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, on this snowy, wintry day. Today we have as our guest, someone who's been long requested, who's a popular guest and who's been in the past, one of the legendary figures in book publishing in the United States, indeed in the world, who's written a new book talking about the fate of media and what can be done about it. Our guest will be Andre Schifrin joining us on the phone today. But first, before we go to our guests, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey. After monitoring the rise of reality television for years, journalist Jennifer Posner was appalled by how reality TV affects our beliefs, our behaviors, and our culture. Her book, Reality Bites Back, The Troubling Truth About Guilty Pleasure TV, deconstructs this media model to show that reality TV is anything but real. To accompany the release of her book, Posner created a satirical webisode series called Reality Rehab with Dr. Jen. Posner says there's often initial resistance to media literacy because people feel attacked when the programs they watch are critiqued. She's hoping the web series will soften the blow.
When people are laughing, you get under their defenses and they are able to think more critically about what they're watching because they're enjoying the process and they don't feel attacked.
Reality TV producers manipulate content rather than filming organic, genuine interactions between people. They also engage in what Posner calls Franken-bite editing, by slicing together quotes to purposefully create the narrative they want to present to viewers.
In reality shows, when you hear a character say something inflammatory in voiceover, but you don't see them actually say it, and you see something going on that may or may not match what is being said, that is often something taken from an entirely different conversation in an entirely different context, sometimes even dubbed in later.
It also turns out that reality TV exists to stealthily market embedded products to the public, not to help someone find a spouse, lose weight, or get a job.
Product placements guide the story arcs and the framing of characters and who is and isn't cast in the first place. If you see, for example, that CoverGirl is a major embedded sponsor of America's Next Top Model, then you start to understand why every season of that show features 9 or 10 young women repeating ad copy over and over about CoverGirl, long lash mascara, improves your life in so many ways.
Posner doesn't want to be a killjoy. She's not asking people to stop watching reality TV.
What I do hope is that we start to create a much more dynamic national conversation about what it is that we're watching, how we're being manipulated, the fact that these shows are not in any way real, the fact that they're reflecting advertisers' biases, not American values at the turn of the century.
To find her book and watch the web series, visit realitybitesbackbook.com.
The national context is you have 2.4 million people who are incarcerated. Many of them are cut off from any form of communication with the outside world or in faraway places from their families.
Nick Subela is the artistic director of Thousand Kites, a national dialogue project that uses theater, radio, the internet, and live events to address issues within the United States criminal justice system. The program began a decade ago when inmates began writing letters to Subela's community radio station about human rights abuses. One of Thousand Kites' annual projects is Calls from Home, an annual holiday radio program that connects families and friends of the incarcerated. Anyone can call into the toll-free number and leave a message that will then be put into a program.
We ask people around the country to call in and speak directly to those inside, and many prisoner families do, and friends of prisoners. And then we work really hard to get that broadcast on about 150 radio stations. And then really more importantly, folks take the audio and they play it in their community, and they also take it into prisons and play it in the prisons where radio signals aren't reaching folks.
The project begins recruiting in mid-November through email outreach, postcards, and a network of previous participants to get the calls coming in.
It's always pretty amazing. Sometimes we've had people do entire plays that they've written where they have five people on the phone. We've had children who are talking to their parent who's incarcerated for the first time. We just had a really beautiful call where a woman just set the phone down and played three really beautiful songs on her guitar while singing. So, you know, we get a range of calls from folks across the country.
The calls themselves vary in content, but they are mostly uplifting.
People talking about keep your head up, keep your eye on the prize, we're still thinking about you, you're not forgotten. My phone has been, cut off, and I haven't had money to call you for the last year. So I'm taking this as an opportunity to speak directly to you.
You can leave a message for calls from home by calling the toll-free number 877-410-4863. Learn more about Thousand Kites at www.kitescampaigns.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, December 12, 2010, here on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful and wintry Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is someone I've been eager to have back on the show ever since his last appearance a few years ago, which was one of the most popular shows I think we did at that time. He is Andre Schifrin, the author of the brand new book, Words and Money. Andre Schifrin was the publisher for 30 years for Pantheon Books. Then in 1990, he left Pantheon to found the New Press. He's the author of several other books, including The Business of Publishing and A Political Education, as well as the recently published Dr. Seuss and Company, Go to War, the World War II editorial cartoons of America's leading comic artists. His new book, Words and Money, just published by Verso, just hot off the press. And it is indeed a great honor to have Andre Schifrin joining us today. Andre, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Well, as you know, I very much enjoyed this book, and I highly recommend it to people interested in the crisis of media today, and putting it in a historical context and looking at comparative models and how we can maybe think about moving forward in what are very trying times. And I think the place I'd like to start is in your own background as really one of the great book publishers in New York publishing and American publishing, the second half of the 20th century. Your experience, I think, informs this book and informs your life, obviously. Could you just talk, for listeners who are unfamiliar with the book publishing industry in broad strokes, how book publishing existed, say, in the 1960s and into the 70s, and how it changed by the 1990s or by this decade?
Right. Well, I was lucky enough to start out in the early 60s. I was just in my 20s at the time, but I got to work first in a mass market publishing house and then at Pantheon, where in the old days, and these are indeed the old days, publishing was still viewed as a profession and not as an industry. And the people who ran Random House, who had just bought up Pantheon, saw it not as a source of a great deal of money, but as a source of new and interesting books and authors. So I was given permission and encouragement, in effect, to find the best books I possibly could. And that's the way we worked for many decades. I was lucky to be in publishing at that time. Nowadays, what we did then would simply not be possible, certainly not in the context of a large corporation. Random House in those days was still relatively small and independent. It was later bought up by RCA and then sold on to various other people, including Condé Nast and then eventually the German conglomerate Bertelsmann. And at that time, things began to change, as it did in all of publishing. Large conglomerates were interested in making as much money as they could out of publishing, and the amount of money that was traditionally there was just pathetic as far as they were concerned. All of publishing in America and Europe in the 20th century averaged 3-4% a year, including the most commercial firms. The large conglomerates who were making up to 26% a year in the newspapers they owned thought this was ridiculous and said, in effect, you have to change your ways and try and earn as much more money as possible. And when it came to Pantheon, it was clear that the agenda was not only that we had to earn more money, but that we should, and that is 4, 5, 6 times what publishers have been earning, but also that we should give up some of the political books we were publishing that were left to center and that were not pleasing to Cy Newhouse and the people he had hired to run the Condé Nast empire. So at that point, we all decided to leave, and I started the New Press a year later, which was started as a not-for-profit precisely to avoid the kind of pressures and problems we had in the past.
Andre, Andre Schifrin, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney, the host. We're talking right now about his background in book publishing, and he's the author of the book Words and Money, we'll be talking about for the entire hour. Andre, when I was in your apartment in New York, oh, I don't know, 5 or 10 years ago, I had the privilege of meeting you there, and you had this wonderful bookshelf in your living room, I believe, filled with these extraordinary books. And I remember commenting to you, wow, these are some really great books you've got here. And you said, modestly enough, well, those are all the ones I edited and published. And it was almost like the who's who of the most important public intellectuals of the 1960s and 70s, as I recall. And I don't want to mention names for fear that I would leave someone out. But could any of those sort of books that were published by commercial publishing houses, those sort of books be published today by commercial publishing houses? Or what percentage could be published today?
Well, practically none, because of the way in which the new system works. And each new book has to persuade the salespeople that it has a large enough potential audience to be worth publishing, so that it'll be profitable enough not only to cover its own costs, but to add to the enormous overheads of the million-dollar salaries of the people running the firms. So that, for instance, when we started to publish Foucault, if I had been asked to prove to the salespeople that there was an audience for Foucault or for Chomsky or Hobsbawm or any of a number of other people, I couldn't have done so, because by definition, new ideas don't have a pre-established audience. So the system works as a kind of very effective censorship filter, in effect. New ideas, whatever they are, they could be on the right as well as on the left, are not going to find an immediate audience and are not going to persuade people that they can make money. And that's, of course, what keeps a lot of these books out. At the New Press now, in the 20 years or so since I've been there, we've published over 1,000 books. And I would say that at least 990 of them would never have been taken on by a large commercial house.
I think I'm the author of a couple of those, for editorial disclosure here.
Right. Well, you would know as well, if not better than I, what their chances would have been with the large commercial publishers, at least at the outset, before your name became as well known as it now is. I think nobody would have touched them.
Andre Schifrin, our guest today. Now, Andre, you spend roughly half your time in Paris or in Europe, and half your time still in New York. And this book is really very much a comparative study. And one of the things I found interesting was that the crisis in American book publishing, which you've been experiencing and writing about for decades now, is something that for a long time Europeans thought was a peculiarly American phenomenon and not really of great importance to them. What's been happening in Europe with regard to book publishing in the past 10 or 20 years?
Well, unfortunately, the same conglomerates that we have here in the U.S. are now in Europe, and indeed many of them are from Europe. Five of the major conglomerates that control American publishing are English or German firms. So the same phenomenon is taking place everywhere, and you can't really even think of national publishing anymore in terms of the larger firms. The largest French publisher, Hachette, is also a major American publisher. It's the second largest publisher in England, in Spain, and so on and so forth. So you have a phenomenon where the same development that I've just described is indeed going to be the case all over the world. And the people in Europe who read the last book said to me, look, we thought when your first book came out, you were much too pessimistic. Much too optimistic. You thought that these things wouldn't happen in Europe. And now, if you look back, we'll see you were wrong. These things are going to happen here as well as there.
Our guest today, Andre Schifrin, author of Words and Money. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment to Media Matters today, the phone number is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Andre Schifrin, the author of Words and Money, longtime book publisher, first with Pantheon Books, and then for the last two decades with the New Press, author of many books before this as well. Andre, one of the issues, too, that's really dramatically changed, there's a bunch of them you talk about in the book and a bunch that I want to mention over the air, is what's happened to retail sales of books and how that's changed both with retail stores and going online. What have been the big changes and how have they affected the industry?
Well, I'm glad you're raising that issue, Bob, because that is a key. Any publisher will tell you that if you have a new and interesting book, the only way it's going to get out and reach an audience is by having booksellers who actually know what it is and can recommend it to people. And one of the big differences between Europe and the U.S. is the way the bookstores have been kept alive there, as opposed to the U.S., where they've disappeared for the most part. And that's an important footnote to what we're talking about. Americans tend to think that what's happening here, whether it's the disappearance of newspapers or of bookstores, is a kind of inevitable international trend. And they forget that all of these things are decided primarily by the policies of each country, and that many of these decisions are not the invisible hand of the market. They're the very visible hand of the government and the way the government decides what kind of country they want to have. So in France and in Germany and much of Europe, you have a law which forbids discounting of books. Now, that doesn't seem like a crucial thing to Americans who are so used to discounts, but in fact, it's the one way you can keep the small independent bookstores from being swamped by the chains and by the large discount stores. So that in the U.S., we now have primarily the big chains, and they are in trouble. Borders and Barnes & Noble have been talking about merging. But in the meantime, they have more or less killed off most of the independent stores, they and Amazon. So that if you look at a city like New York, where I live, you'll see that when I was a kid and I worked after school in the bookstore, we had 333 bookstores. Nowadays, they're under 30, and that includes the chain stores. And overall, in the country, where a few years ago there were something like 5,000 bookstores, there are now 1,200, according to the Booksellers Association, that are independent. So you see a major change that has come about primarily because the discounts allowed the large chains and the large stores to undermine the small publishers, the small bookstores and the small publishers as well. And that's a key difference. In Germany alone, for instance, there are still 8,000 bookstores, a country which has like a third of the American population. So those distinctions matter enormously. That, of course, and the lack of any kind of rent control for stores in the central city, which means that the store, the one bookstore across the street from us here in New York, that was still one of the few remaining in New York, got such a rent increase the other year that it had to close its doors, and 3 years later that storefront is still empty.
Andre, you've already sort of alluded to this point, but it's worth returning to. For a small independent publisher, someone who's not part of a big conglomerate or doesn't have an enormous distribution network with a vast marketing apparatus, how significant has been the disappearance of these small independent bookstores around the country, you know, from 5,000 to 1,200, and most of the 1,200 that remain are probably, you know, chain? Or what does that mean for, you know, the new press, for example, the press you've worked with, and you're publishing all these books that wouldn't get through the filters of the commercial system?
Right. Well, it's made life much, much more difficult. And, of course, ironically, it's helped Amazon because people can't find the book in the stores that they go to in the chain stores, so they buy from Amazon. And Amazon now is responsible for about 20% of the sales of books here and in Europe. But, of course, Amazon itself is a terrible danger because they are increasingly demanding higher discounts from books, from publishers, demanding better terms for their e-books, and in general trying to suck all the profit out of what is a very unprofitable industry.
So you're, if I can judge the comments you just made accurately, you are not necessarily one of the believers that Amazon is saving book publishing in the United States.
No, unfortunately. I think Amazon, if it has its way, will kill everything off because there have been, you know, documentation of the battle they had with the book publishers earlier in the year where they wanted to set a price of $9.99 for all books, and which assured that they would get the profit and the publishers and the authors wouldn't. Now, they fell back from that briefly, though after threatening to delist all the books from all of the publishing houses that disagreed with them. And by the way, why the antitrust division didn't step in at this point is something I certainly don't understand, because it was a clear violation of antitrust policy. But in any case, by making books available on their e-books, which I have nothing against per se, they are taking greater and greater control of distribution. And, of course, they're not going to spend any of the money to get the books written. They're not going to be the ones who give an advance to an author or edit the text. They're just going to take the product, as they call it, at the very end of the line and make as much money as they can out of it. But, of course, the hard work is done by other people, and they're the ones who are going to be increasingly at risk.
Right. Now you said Amazon gets roughly 20% of the books, or it has 20% of the revenues for book sales in the United States. I'm surprised it's that low, frankly, given what's happened to retail, and understand that Amazon largely has a monopoly over online sales, at least for new books. Is that percentage, is that moving rapidly higher, or has that been stable for a while?
Well, I think, the figures from Amazon are not really credible, so it's hard to tell. They will now tell you that 9% of their sales are for e-books, but we don't really know what that is 9% of. So those figures have to be taken with a certain amount of salt because we have no independent verification. What's scary is that they're doing as well in Europe, even if they can't do the discounting. On the other hand, as Barnes & Noble discovered and as they have discovered, there are other people who can do to them what they did to the independent bookstores, and that is the Walmarts and the others will discount, heavily discount, new major bestsellers simply to get customers into the store. And so in the last years, we've seen the phenomenon of Walmart and the others competing to see who can charge the least for a new bestseller. And, of course, Amazon doesn't want to compete on those terms. So you have a situation where, in England, for instance, the big discount, the Costco equivalents, were selling the last Harry Potter for £1 instead of £20, simply to get people to come into the store. Now, that means that the stores that would normally have made their year's profit from selling Harry Potter were losing a huge percentage of the potential sale, and that even applies to Amazon.
Our guest today, Andre Schifrin. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters on WILL AM 580. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Andre Schifrin, the number here is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Among other things, we're discussing his brand-new book just published by Verso, Words and Money. It just came out. I've had the privilege of reading it, and it's a very enjoyable, very informed read. And in the book, Andre Schifrin, one of the things that you also take up that I found interesting, and you cover the range of media. We were talking about book publishing now, but we'll get to everything else along the way. But one of the things you take up is this notion of the role of university presses and how they're sort of, to some extent, trying to pick up some of the slack that of what the commercial houses have dropped over the last two or three decades as they've gone to a pure sort of bestseller blockbuster model. How has that worked out, and what does the future hold for university presses from your perspective?
Well, the development of the university presses has been twofold. Part of the development, and I have a whole chapter on this in the business of books, is that they've become profit centers, so that many universities, the University of Chicago is the most notorious example, where they actually applied the thinking of their economics faculty to the university itself, and every department had to be profitable. The press itself and the books that came from it had to be profitable at the end of the year. So that has meant an enormous change in what is published by university presses, and increasingly they've taken up what used to be the mid-list of the large publishers. And I remember the other year, for instance, the University of California published one of Antonius Fraser's biographies of the British royalty, perfectly respectable book of the kind that used to be published by Knopf, but proved not to be profitable enough for the new owners, and therefore had been taken over by University of California. Now, that is a terrible misuse of the facilities and important machinery of the university press, just as the universities themselves have stopped teaching subjects that aren't profitable enough, abandoning foreign languages and cultures and the like. At the same time, there is a counter-trend, though it's a very small one, of having universities give over some of their space to independent publishers who are able to publish as not-for-profits from their offices. And the example I gave for many years was the Dahlke Archive, which started in Normal, Illinois, of all places, and has now moved to a larger campus and has become one of the major publishers of foreign fiction these days, because they had, in effect, a subsidy from the university press a free office and a professor who's given part-time to do this. The University of Rochester has recently had another similar spin-off called Open Letters, which also publishes translation. So you have now the possibility that universities can make up for some of the lack in the large publishing houses, but at the same time, looking at it globally, the negatives are greater than the positives.
Andre Schiffen, around 10.5 years ago, early in 2000, I was at a conference in the Northeast, and there was a publisher from another small commercial publishing house, book publishing house there, who I knew, and he had published books, none of mine, but books of friends of mine. And he told me that in his office pool at the publishing house, they'd had a pool for when the last print book would be published and everything would be electronic. And this, again, to remind you, was 2000, 10.5 years ago. And I was, so he was really sort of quite impressed with this pool he'd had in his office. So I said, well, what did you say? When did you say the last print book would ever be published? And he said, next year. And I was sort of frightened by that thought, not being a huge fan of having to read on a computer screen all the time. Fortunately, he was proven wrong, but it seems like, you know, we are now, what he anticipated taking place 10 years ago has been starting to take place in the last 2 or 3 years with Kindle and the rise of e-books. You mentioned just a few seconds ago or a few minutes ago that this was not necessarily a process that, you know, you were opposed to, but I'm curious what your take is, and specifically, is the process of reading a book on a screen, no matter how it's done, is it changed the whole nature of reading and with that writing?
Well, you know, that's not necessarily a pool I would have jumped into at the time. And I think there is, as you know far better than most, that with every new technology, there's an assumption that that will change everything. You documented that extremely well with the beginning of radio in America. And there's, a lot to be looked at in the past in terms of believing that technology will affect content in a way that isn't necessarily the case. There's a new book by an author called John Woo that has just come out in these last few weeks that looks precisely at this point. And I remember when television started, I thought, oh my God, you know, suddenly we're going to be able to see every marvelous old movie that's ever been shown. We're going to be able to see every great lecture at every university and so on and so forth. And of course, we know what you can see on television these days. So a similar phenomenon is happening with the technology of the e-book, and that is that for the most part, it's the bestsellers that are going to be on the e-book, and most people aren't even going to know the other books are around. Now, you know, the word publishing involves the root of it, and the actuality of it means making something public. And unless people know that a book is around, they're not going to ask for it on Amazon or on their e-book. They're only going to know about it if they find it in a book review, which is increasingly a rare phenomenon, or in a good bookstore. And I always say a good bookstore is not the one that has the book you wanted, but the book you didn't know you wanted. So you have a situation where the number of people who are going to read may increase, but the number of books they're going to read will probably decrease. Now, the one place where the system has worked very well of electronic publishing has been in the world of university presses, actually. And there you have the phenomenon where the average university press monograph was down to a sale of 350 copies. And the reason for that is that's the exact number of university libraries throughout the world that still have a budget to buy the new scholarly work. And Bob Darnton, who's written some very important stuff, which we can talk about later on this whole issue, was the first one to say, look, this is crazy. We might as well put all the university monographs on the web, have them downloaded by the universities themselves for their libraries, and you'll save a huge amount of money in the process. And that is what has happened. He got a grant from the Mellon Foundation to help with the editing of the books, which, of course, is a very considerable expense. And now the monographs have mostly gone onto the web. But that's because they're aimed at a very specific, very small audience of people who know they want the book. If you put your novel on the web, assuming that somebody other than your cousin is going to read it, you're going to be among the hundreds of thousands of people who have done so and who have never reached anybody. There's too much stuff there. There's no filtering system. There's no way of knowing what it is or whether it's worth looking at. And people simply aren't going to look at it.
Our guest today, Andre Schifrin, author of Words and Money. If you'd like to call into the question or comment, the line is open at 333-9455 or our toll-free line at 1-800-222-9455. Andre Schifrin, author of the new book, Words and Money. In the book, Andre Schifrin, you do a tour of Europe, and you go through how Europe has addressed some of the same problems the United States has been facing with regard to the collapse of traditional media industries, not just book publishing, but newspapers and magazines and cinema, for that matter. And you look at some of the policies that democratic nations in Europe have employed or have not employed in some cases and the effects they've had to improve the situation. One country in particular you devote attention to is Norway. Could you talk a little bit about what's taking place in Norway that makes you want to shine a light on it?
Right. Well, Norway is a fascinating exception. And even in Europe, when the book has now appeared in various European countries, everybody said they had no idea what was going on in Norway. And the Norwegians are really a remarkable country. They don't belong to the EU. They've been independent of everybody for a very long time. They have a long tradition of wanting to keep control of their own country. And what they've done is establish a budget for cultural affairs, which makes sure that this is going to happen. Now, when I say that, everybody says, oh, North Sea Oil, no wonder they're so rich, they have all this money. And that's not the case. The North Sea Oil money goes into a separate fund, which is segregated. Its use is going to be limited to future projects for in Norway. When the oil runs out, they've been very cautious about this. They take the money out of their normal budget, like any other country, and what they do is do various things. First of all, they help subsidize any newspaper that has political opinion or is not for profit so that there is a lively discourse and democratic debate. The government does not in any way control content any more than it does on the television and radio that it subsidizes. And it's made a point of being sure that in Norway, the major newspapers in Oslo have a circulation which is practically the same as the major newspapers in Paris, a country which is 13 times bigger than Norway. Norway has 4.5 million people, and yet the government will buy each year 1,200, 1,500 copies of each of the major new books in fiction and nonfiction and poetry and so on, and give 2 copies to every library in the country so that every library is up to date. Readers in the northernmost parts of the country are as well served as those in the big cities. And at the same time, the authors and publishers can keep going because they get the income from those sales. Now, when I started out in publishing, you could be sure in England and in the U.S. that you'd have 1,500 copies of sales guaranteed to the libraries of any worthwhile book that you published. But that was in a country, you know, many, many times the size of Norway, the same number of books. Now that has gone away. In the Reagan-Thatcher years in the U.S. and England, the money was taken away from the public libraries so that they just try to keep up with the latest bestsellers and not much else. They don't have money to do much more than that. And that, of course, is another huge difference. And finally, and this is something everybody thinks happened just recently, but actually happened in 1913, the Norwegians municipalized most of the movie houses. So you don't have the multiplexes. You don't have the latest Hollywood movies crowding out everything else. You have movie houses throughout the country where the managers can decide what their customers want to see. And the customers themselves don't have to worry that if a new film comes out that's good but not that commercial, it'll disappear within a few days, as is the case with our multiplexes. So you have a whole coherent system which has been built on the idea of preserving democracy, preserving debate, and preserving choice in a country that could easily have been overwhelmed by the neighbors that were larger and had a larger population than they did. And they've decided, no, we don't want that. We want to have control of our own future. So they are a remarkable example. The book is filled with examples, though, from other countries. And the French, for instance, you know, have a policy not only of helping the publication of books, but of maintaining the bookstores. If you're a small bookstore in France and you're in trouble, you can get a loan, or if you want to start one, you can get a loan of up to 40,000 euros to get going, or for an older owner to pass it on to younger people, a situation which means that you have, at least 1,000 first-rate bookstores throughout the country, a country which, you know, as we say, has a far smaller population than the U.S., less than a sixth.
You know, I love the what you said a few minutes ago, Andre Schifrin, about how a great bookstore isn't a bookstore where you can find the book you want, but rather where you find the book you didn't know you wanted until you saw it there. And I was wondering, because friends of mine have talked about this with Amazon. They say, well, that phenomenon goes true with Amazon, with their algorithms, that when you demonstrate an interest in a topic, then you can surf all sorts of related books that you would, and it has the same effect as being in a bookstore, looking at through a bunch of titles you would never see otherwise. Is that a legitimate comparison, or is there something missing in that equation, in that algorithm?
Well, I think you just have to ask people how they feel themselves about it. I'm much more comfortable looking at a bookstore and seeing the actual books and leafing through them than looking on the Amazon screen, where they say people who bought this book are interested in this, and then they give me a commercial. They give me a selection that's already been paid for by some publisher without admitting that that's the case. So you need to have faith in the people who you're dealing with, and you have to know that they're making honest suggestions. And that, I'm afraid, is not always the case with Amazon.
Andre Schifrin, before we get back to the discussion in the book and of media, there is a current media issue I very much want to get your opinion on. Which is dominating, of course, pretty much all the news about media issues and First Amendment issues in the United States for the last week or two, which is the WikiLeaks story. And I'm just interested in what your take is on that and what the issues are and where you come down on them.
Well, of course, this is more recent than the book itself, so I don't have anything in the book about this, and I'm reacting just like any other citizen. I think, on the whole, I have to say that I'm in favor of what they've tried to do. I think they've done us a real service, and not necessarily the service they thought they were doing. As you read through the material that's coming out, a lot of it is pretty obvious, and the only conclusion you can come from it is that, well, at least the people in the State Department are no dumber than we are, but they're certainly not better informed. And that's interesting in itself. I don't think that was the intention of the WikiLeaks people, who I'm sure were dealing with some of the more scandalous affairs. They have, however, left the decision to the newspapers as to what they're going to publish, which in a way was the correct decision for them to take, but it did run some risks. I mean, there are specific cases, for instance, where there were some telling documents that the New York Times has decided not to run, or rather has perhaps been asked by the government not to run. For instance, on this whole missile shield question, WikiLeaks published a long report from the Russians showing very convincingly that the Iranian missiles could never reach Europe, and that the American excuse for setting up the missile shield against the Iranians was simply not justifiable. Now, for some reason, that document was not republished by the Times, and I'm not quite sure who suggested that they not do so, but it wasn't there, and that would have been an important element in the future discussion of what's going on. So, potentially, the documents could be very useful. I think, initially, a lot of what's come out has not quite been as useful as one would have hoped.
It does seem that it's becoming an important First Amendment issue, given the way the government is responding to it and politicians are responding to it. And I'm wondering, again, this is not in your book, nor the topic of Words and Money necessarily, directly at least, but you've lived in the United States for most of your life, and you have seen this country go through extraordinary changes over the last, say, 50 or 60 years. As you look at the U.S. today, and you not just looking at the WikiLeaks debate, but just looking at the caliber of our political debate and political culture, where do you think we are in some sort of historical arc based on your experience?
Well, that's certainly a broad enough question. And the memoir I published the other year, The Political Education, which you mentioned.
Yeah, we had you on the show for that.
Right, indeed. And I'm glad to hear the show was a success. I hadn't realized that. But, you know, in that book I talk about what America was like during the McCarthy period, the post-war period, where the amount of choice that, you know, we were offered in the media and the press was extremely limited. And so having lived through that, you know, it's hard to find anything since then that's been quite as bad. But it does show the degree to which the media can be manipulated, and we saw that, of course, during the Iraqi War, and this is a major argument in this new book, that if you don't have a diversity of independent voices, then you're not going to hear some of the basic facts that need to be heard. And I'm persuaded that if the press had done its job during the period leading up to the Iraqi War, we wouldn't have had the war. That the evidence already available was so damning that the Bush lies could have been blown out of the water if the press had determined to do so. And one of the interesting examples that I came up with is that right after 9/11, a small publishing house, Seven Stories, did a little book of Noam Chomsky's about future policies. And that book immediately sold an incredible 300,000 copies. So it showed that there was a market, that there were people interested in criticism, that there were people who would have bought a book. And yet none of the large houses for the first crucial 2 years of the war published anything critical of the Bush policy. So it shows that the large conglomerates, for various reasons, were not willing to take the risk and not willing to play the democratic role that the press is supposed to play. And that was true, of course, of most of the newspapers as well. So there is a reason for having the hagiography of the Fourth Estate, of saying, you know, that this is an important part of our government, and if we don't have these countervailing powers, we're in trouble. And that is indeed something that we can see now more and more often.
Andre Schiffen, as I read your book, as I listen to you talk, I don't quite get the sense that you're of the mind that the Internet and the digital revolution is going to completely replace and eliminate traditional media. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, you know, I'm not even sure that's a question, Bob, because I'm all for the Internet, but the question is, where does the content come from? The Internet, for instance, during the Iraqi War, had very important content against the war, but it came from the Manchester Guardian or from Le Monde or from European papers that had actually sent somebody to the places and who had written the articles the Internet could use. So I think there's an important distinction between form and content. There's nothing wrong with the form of the Internet as a way of getting the news out to lots of people and doing many of the things that it does today, which is useful. But it is not a way of getting the content. Sure, there are people who are able to do a website on what's going on in their local neighborhood or their local school or whatever, and there's nothing wrong with that. But it's not the same as having a network of trained professionals who go and look for stories and bring them out. And you see this even at the local level here. Most of the American papers have shut down their branches in the state capital, which used to be a major source of local corruption and used to depend on the press to root that out. You don't have that anymore. You don't have these trained journalists covering the beat because it's just not profitable enough for the newspapers to keep them when they're getting rid of the staff. And the most shocking statistic in the book, to my mind, is that in 2008, 16,000 journalists lost their jobs. And in the beginning of the first months of 2009, another 10,000 did. So what you're having is the prospect of newspapers no longer having a staff, working from wire services, working from handouts, and no longer doing the job that they're supposed to be there for.
And in the book, you argue that this is a public policy issue. This is something that can be addressed. In looking at Europe and seeing what other countries have done or not done in some cases, what do you think the sort of policies that get your attention that Americans ought to be considering to sort of resurrect or rejuvenate the production of content?
Right. Well, it's a question of money. It's a question of getting money to the newspapers so that they will actually have the staff, have the bureaus overseas, and be able to cover the news. You know, the Baltimore Sun, one of the best of the provincial papers, recently shut down its last overseas office, so that increasingly you're going to be dependent either on the wire services or have less and less of a news hall for this kind of thing. Now, the question of funding of the press, of course, is the crucial one, and it's one that you've addressed very well in your last book. But I would go further, and what I would point out is that, you know, the newspapers now are based on income from advertising, and that advertising is going to the Internet. So that source will disappear. I think there's no question that it's going to dry up. But the feeling that we've all had that if there's ads, it's free, whether it's radio or television or the press, is an erroneous one. If you have advertising, you're paying for it. It's a private tax, in effect. Whenever you buy a box of Soapflex, you're paying for the cost of advertising it on the television. You're paying for it indirectly, and you don't realize you're doing it, but you are paying for it nonetheless. So why not come up with other forms of funding, which are also indirect taxes, on the consumer, but actually have a better result? And I think that's the question that needs to be debated in the future as we look at the press and see that, you know, 83% of young people think there won't be a paper around in a decade, like your professor friend. This is something that is dangerous to democracy, and we have to find the ways of paying for it that we haven't considered in the past.
Do you think the European nations, the ones you write about in the book and the ones you visit with some frequency, are more alert to this issue than the people are in the United States?
I think they're alert to it, but they're more open to the solutions. And by the way, the same thing happens in Canada, where most of the press gets help from the government, just as the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, has for years, like the BBC, been based on a tax on your television set. And, you know, that's one of the things that we have to realize, that the number of options that we're willing to consider is incredibly limited and unrealistic. The Europeans have been willing to spend much, much more. All the Scandinavian newspapers get help from the government. The French and Italians are giving very considerable help. This is something that can be done without in any way limiting the freedom of the press or dictating what the content is going to be. The American debate in recent years has been more or less how quickly will the newspapers disappear. There's been very little discussion outside of your book as to what could be done to help pay for the newspapers. And that's part of the difficulty, that everyone says, oh, well, we have an economic crisis. How can we talk about other expenditures when we can't even give people who are unemployed a decent compensation? And, of course, that is a real crisis, but the crisis will get a lot worse if we don't have a press that's willing to discuss the issues and willing to look at different solutions.
One other area that you talk about in the book, Andreas Schifrin, and that we've talked about on the show, in fact, deals with the station we're coming on right now, which is an NPR-affiliated station, is public broadcasting. And one of the arguments over the last 20 years is that with the rise of the Internet and multi-channel television, the universe of 500-channel satellite and cable systems, that there's no longer any justification for having any publicly subsidized media like the BBC or CBC, or here in the United States, the community and public family of stations. What is your opinion on that? Where do you believe public broadcasting fits in, and does it have a future? And if so, what sort of future?
Well, I would agree with you, I suspect, in saying that I think public broadcasting is a key to being able to keep the news-gathering system alive and to continue to have an audience, which is still considerable, for the kind of serious coverage that is required. I don't think it was in your book. I think it was in the Columbia University report. It was pointed out that when PBS was first thought of, there was a possibility of having a tax on television sets that would be paid for it to support PBS. And this is, of course, we see now the arguments in Washington to cut the amount of money being given. This is the real danger that under Nixon, when PBS started doing exposés of dishonest businesses and so on, he cut off the budget altogether. So one has to have an independent source of income which is guaranteed and which will help maintain the system as it exists and as it should grow. And part of what can be done, certainly, is that the PBS system of radios and TVs could help supplement the newspapers and feed them the news that they're no longer covering on the local level, and that would be an important development. But they are an essential part of what we need, And it's really dangerous that even now there is talk in Washington of cutting the credits again.
Our guest, Andre Schifrin. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Andre Schifrin is the author of the brand new book, Words and Money, published by Verso. He is the longtime publisher at Pantheon and then the New Press. It's an honor to have him on the show. Let's go to our phone lines now for a caller. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Andre Schifrin.
Yeah, I'm very much interested in this program, and I have read one of Andre Schifrin's books, was very much impressed by it. But what I have in mind now is that I, for one, get much of my information about what's going on in the world via the Internet and via stations like Democracy Now! And Antiwar.com and ZNet. And what strikes me is that they're all under pressure to ask their audience to contribute so that they can continue. So there's a vulnerability there. And I'm just wondering what comments Andre Schifrin would have about this particular form of information and what the future of it is. So I'll just let him.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Andre Schifrin?
Right. Well, I think you've made an important point, and that is the degree to which the funding of all of these, and whether it's the public television or the alternatives, the Democracy Now! And so on, is entirely dependent on viewer contribution, which is certainly better than not having any help at all, but which should really have a much more assured and continuous basis. You can't plan ahead if you're trying to decide entirely on what you're going to be able to raise at the next fundraising. The idea that I'm suggesting, which is that there be some kind of indirect tax, and I think a tax on Google would be a very good solution because they're making a huge amount of money by using the news that is generated by the newspapers and not paying a nickel for it, that a tax on Google and the other access providers would help to create a fund which would go to support of these independent media. There's no reason why people who have not invented the Internet, who have not done any of the scientific work, who do not raise any of the costs of coverage, have full and free use of this to make 25% or 30% of profit a year. I think there's every reason to suggest that they should be made to contribute to the networks on which they rely, and I think setting up a system of this kind, though I realize it's not likely to happen in the next Congress, but which is an idea I think that needs to be discussed for the future of the kind of programs that we all need and want to listen to. I want to add one other thing, though, that the latest statistics on the people who actually read their newspaper on the web is that they spend 7 minutes a day, and that's only for 3% of the people who actually read their newspaper on the web. So what you're seeing is a very shortened version. It's really glancing at the headlines. And what we still need is, you know, the full newspaper, but it takes you a while to read to know what's going on.
Andre, how does that proposed tax on Google that you just mentioned that's in the book, could you briefly just outline what that means exactly or what that entails?
Well, what I'm saying is that Google and the other access providers are making a huge amount of money off of the public sphere. As I said, they didn't invent the Internet. That was government money to begin with. They didn't do the research, and they don't do the journalism that they use. And when you turn on Google, you see the latest headlines and stories from papers throughout the world for which they don't pay a nickel. So I don't see why a percentage of their annual profits, which are very, very considerable, could not be taxed away. Just as you could have a tax on ads on television, there are all sorts of things that are used in Europe as a source of money to pay for the media, and which I think are perfectly legitimate alternatives. In France, for instance, there are taxes on the advertising budgets on TV, and those are used to help to pay for the public channels. These are all sorts of possibilities. Your book is full of all sorts of suggestions of ways in which you can do this indirectly into new funds which are not government-controlled, but are there to help, as with the BBC, to help to pay for the actual journalistic costs.
Andre Schifrin, we have two callers who have been waiting patiently. I'm going to try to get them both in the next few minutes. Let's go immediately now to line two, Urbana. You're on the air with Andre Schifrin.
Hello. I had two questions, but I think I'll cut it down to one. It seems to me that the attrition of the public source of to news is quite convenient to some, or perhaps many, of our politicians, that a dumbed-down populace is much easier to rule, and that we must in some way find a way of circumventing that. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Andre, I guess that's a true-false question.
Well, I would certainly agree with you, and I think just to give you an example, I read in the Times for the first time the other day that the hedge fund people had managed to get a loophole into the tax law which guaranteed them tens of billions of profits every year on their already ridiculous profits. Now, if the Times hadn't mentioned that, I wouldn't have known it, and I'm sure most of the people in our band and elsewhere have never heard about it. And here we are, in which we're having a huge debate on the deficit and on the future of taxes, and the basic facts, such as this one, are just simply not widely available.
Let's go back to the phone lines for our final caller today. Line 4, Peoria, Illinois. You're on the air with Andre Schifrin.
Okie doke. When you talk about independent media, when I turn on the PBS on at 6 p.m. on a weekday and to watch the news hour, I go through about 5 minutes of propaganda from BP and Exxon and Boeing and people like that. I just wonder how independent even public television is. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Andre Schifrin?
Well, that's the result of cutting down on the funding so that they have to depend on, in Illinois, for instance, ADM was paying for a very long time for the news hour, and I haven't seen any exposés on ethanol on that program. So there's no question that the pressures on the news hour have been enormous, both from the government and from the advertisers, to keep limits on what they're going to report on, and I think that's clear from anybody who watches that program. So what you need is real independence, and real independence does come from having your own source of money and not having to depend. And this is one of the things the Republicans have tried to do with PBS for many years, is to make it so dependent on large corporate funding that it's not going to do the exposés that they might have done.
Andre Schifrin, we've only got about a minute left. What is the response to your book and your arguments? What has it been so far?
The book has just come out in the last week, but the initial reviews have been surprisingly good. The one thing that hasn't happened, which I hope in time will be a debate on the kind of policy issues that I'm raising. And that's hard to do, as you know from yourself. People aren't yet ready to think of what are the alternatives to what everybody seems to see as an unending crisis. And that, I hope, will come, and thanks to programs like this, perhaps in time it will.
Well, Andre Schifrin, I want to thank you very much for taking time out of your schedule to join us today and talk about your book, Words and Money, just published by Verso Books. And I wish you the best of luck with it, Andre.
Well, thank you very much, Bob, and thanks for the program.